Hi, I'm Jerry Kenny.
And I'm Nina Ellis. Now would be a good time to find a comfy place on the couch, because we've got an hour of storytelling coming up.
First, a short story by Yellow Springs writer Scott Geisel. It's called Spring Early, and it's set here in the village where WYSO has its home.
And then our news reporters and volunteers have made a present for you, true life stories told by citizens of Yellow Springs at the post office.
Scott Geisel's story is part of a new anthology called Christmas Stories from Ohio, published by Kent State University Press. It appears alongside stories by Paul Lawrence Dunbar, Nikki Giovanni, Langston Hughes, James Thurber, and many other Ohio writers.
It'll be read by Mary Donahoe, for many years a theater arts professor at Wright State University and a longtime resident of Yellow Springs. Enjoy the story, and Merry Christmas from the staff and volunteers of WYSO.
Spring Early by Scott Geisel. Christine Everhart just wanted to be left alone. She leaned forward and pedaled harder into the cold Ohio wind. No one asking how she'd been, what she'd been up to, how she likes being home again. Will she be staying for the holidays? Just 10 minutes to herself would do some good. 10 minutes without the questions, without the memories. The ancient Swin 3-speed shuddered into potholes and over curbs, and the cold bit into Christine's cheeks and settled in her feet and hands. How had she ever done this as a child and thought nothing of it? Had Ohio really always been this cold? She left for college and warmer climates right after high school, took the bus down to Florida with a boy she started dating her senior year. They fell more deeply in love, settled in Jacksonville, and liked it. The warmth, the beach, a city big enough to get lost in. Nothing like here. Christine loved her family, and so had Mike, and they'd carefully arranged trips for their parents to visit them in Jacksonville. In 15 years, Christine had only been home twice. Once for Mike's funeral, and now because of her grandmother's stroke. Spending Christmas at home was so far proving more challenging than she'd expected. When Christine rounded the corner from Walnut onto Elm and saw the bright orange cones lining the street in front of the school, she knew she'd made a mistake. Last day before Christmas break, and they were getting out early, just like when she'd gone to school at Shady Elm Elementary. A few kids trickled out the doors into the early afternoon sun, and then a flood of color and motion erupted. Coats, hats, arms, legs, and book bags fluttering and churning through the schoolyard toward the crosswalk. Christine dodged another pothole and tried to force the rusted shift lever down into first gear. The chain stuttered and popped off the sprocket, and she felt the pedals slip beneath her feet as she skittered to a stop in front of the crosswalk, where the sea of children swallowed her up. This was the opposite of alone. Christine looked down to examine the damage, and a hand reached through the chatter and giggles to her shoulder. "Do you need some help?" the voice offered. She looked up at Officer McLean. How could he still be on the force? He was old when he'd been manning the school crossing when she was a child. "No," Christine said, but she waited until the children had crossed and let him walk the bike with her to the curb. Officer McLean bent to examine the damage. "All rusted up," he said. "I don't know how you were riding this thing." "Didn't shift," Christine said. He pulled a Swiss Army knife from his pocket, extracted the screwdriver blade, and wedged the chain loose from the gears on the back tire. "This might get you home," he said, "but I wouldn't go on any cross-country trips." "I'm headed to Creighton's," she said. Officer McLean raised an eyebrow. "You don't already have one. You ought to pick up a can of oil while you're there." Christine thanked him and pushed off down the street. How could she escape her past when it was still alive? All around her, a breathing mass of history. Creighton's Hardware looked like it always had. Small and cramped with narrow aisles, but an amazing array and variety of tools, hardware and supplies, all arranged so that at least one of each item was visible on a shelf. There were still the pots and pans and kitchen utensils, coffee makers and pressure cookers, and the basement with plumbing supplies, which was ironic because the basement flooded every time there was even a modest rain. And just as Christine had expected, the front window was once again packed full with Christmas decorations, lights, miniature trees, wrapping paper, and gift items. It was ablaze with the holiday. She took her time picking out one set of white lights and one of blue from the window display, looking through the other items as she did to make mental notes for later. She still hadn't found a gift for her parents. Usually it was a mail-order item. Fruit of the month club, something nice for the house, or an item they'd picked out themselves. But with Grandma's stroke and the phone calls and distractions and last-minute travel plans, she hadn't gotten to it yet this year. And with Christmas just a few days away, there wasn't time to have a package sent. When she turned the corner into the row of electronic supplies, there was something new. John Houston, standing with an elderly woman and explaining how a three-way light bulb worked. He was wearing a red Creighton's apron around his waist. John smiled when he saw Christine, but didn't turn his attention from the woman until she had gone. "Christine," he said, coming from behind the register toward her. "Long time." His hair was darker than she remembered and a little thinner at the temples, but he was the same guy she remembered from high school. Thin, big ears, and the best smile she'd ever seen. They had dated before she went with Mike. John had talked about college but dragged his feet. Christine had just wanted to get out. "Finding everything?" John asked. "Extension cord," Christine said. He stepped around her and picked one up from the shelf. "What length?" "Green," she said. "It has to be green." He put the cord back and walked down the aisle. "Those are all up front with the Christmas lights." She followed him, and he reached deep into the display case in the window. "6 feet okay?" "Fine," she said, and he handed one to her. "I heard you were in town," he said, "and I'm sorry to hear about your grandma." Christine flinched. "Geez, does everybody know everything around here? Everywhere I go, it's like people are expecting me. Everyone knows I'm home. Mom's made the rounds. At the post office, at the bank, I can't buy a banana without someone asking me how I've been or how's Grandma." John shrugged. "Just like always." "So how is she?" Christine let out a breath. "The same." The stroke hit her right side, and that was her dominant arm. "So she's having a hard time adjusting." John nodded. "She's at home?" Christine shook her head. "Out of the hospital, but staying with Mother and Dad. She can't be on her own." "I wish her a speedy recovery," John said, then looked thoughtful for a moment. "So, no spring earlies this year?" Christine looked up at him. "Did you say spring early?" "I did. You know they're called springerly, right?" she said, drawing out the spring and the and the lee. John laughed. "I've called them that since I was a kid. Your grandmother always sent some cookies to my grandmother, and I always got a few. These past few years, she's been sending them to my mother. I still get some. No one else makes spring earlies like your grandmother." Christine examined the extension cord and lights in her hand. It was true. She still got a box mailed to her every year. They were perfect. A thin, crunchy layer on the outside and a soft, cakey inside that was so strong with anise, the whole house was filled with the scent the day they arrived in the mail. "Oh, sorry," John said, "selfish of me. The important thing is your grandma's health." "No, Gram made them early. She said she knew something was going to happen and she baked them in October, right before the stroke. We have a whole pantry full. They're spilling out everywhere. That ought to make her happy." Christine stood silently. She supposed it did. "Okay. Anything else?" John asked. "Oil," she said. "I need a can of oil." He started off across the store. "What kind?" "For my bike chain. It jammed on the way over here." He picked out a small can and took it to the register, and when he had rung everything up and was putting her things into a bag, he held up the can of oil and asked, "You want me to help you with this? Put some on now?" She looked at him, puzzled. "The bike is outside." "Why does everyone keep trying to help me? Do I look like I need help?" John dropped the can into the paper bag and folded the top over. "Sorry," he said, holding up his hands. "That's twice today. I can't afford another one." "No," Christine said, shaking her head. "It's me. It's just... look, I'd love some help. It's in the rack out front." When he got outside and saw the bike, John laughed. "How old is this thing?" "Old as me," Christine said, already feeling the sting of the cold again on her skin. He wasn't even wearing a coat. John oiled the chain, the derailleur, the cables, the shifter, and then the chain again, wiping the excess with a rag he'd brought from inside. "It's going to need brake pads and air in the tires if you want to keep riding it," he said. Christine pulled her hat down tight, took the can from John, and placed it into the rusted wire basket along with the other items. "I'll do that," she said, putting her mittens on. But before she left, she turned again to John. "There's just one thing I don't understand." "Hmm? Why are you working at a hardware store?" John frowned. "Why are you still here?" she pressed. "You were so smart. You were going to go away. What happened?" The frown got deeper. "I'm working here because Mr. Creighton is a family friend. He needs the help. Christmas is actually a very busy time for him, and he's getting older. Plus, he needs help organizing for the end-of-the-year inventory count." He stuck his hands in his pockets and turned half away from her, speaking now over his shoulder. "I teach chemistry at Oakdale." "Yes, I know. We said we'd never go to a community college. But there's good work to be done here, just the same as anywhere else, you know." Christine closed her eyes. "No, I..." But she heard the bell on the door tinkle, and John was already back inside. The warmth from the kitchen engulfed Christine as she stepped through the door into her parents' house. "Did you get the lights?" Mom called from the living room. "Yes. Bring them in here." Her mother had the couch pulled away from the big window and was hanging ornaments from hooks that were stuck to the glass with little suction cups. With Grandma in the wheelchair, there hadn't been room for a tree this year. Christine recognized many of the items already hanging, but there were several she'd never seen before. There was a bird made out of painted walnut shells and cardboard, a bell made from pipe cleaners and paper snowflakes that were yellowed and falling apart. There were also some very nice things. Little crystal balls, a carved wooden Santa, an angel made of lace. "Where did these come from?" Christine asked, leaning over the back of the couch. She touched one of the paper snowflakes, and it danced fragilely under her fingertip. Mom put an arm on her shoulder. "You like 'em? These were on our tree when I was a kid." She pointed to the walnut bird. "I made that in second grade." Then she turned the lumpy pipe cleaner bell on its hook. "And your Uncle Dave, rest his soul, made this 2 years later in the same class, in the very same seat where I sat. Your grandmother always liked that." Christine looked at her mother and noticed for the first time since she'd been home these past few days the gray in her hair that she couldn't completely hide anymore, and a thinness in her fingers she didn't remember. Mom didn't look old, but she no longer looked young. "Why haven't I seen them before?" Christine asked. "They were in your grandma's attic," Mom said. "She asked your dad to bring them down." Christine must have looked confused, because Mom added, "When you were young, we hung the things you made in school. They're still here." She pointed to the origami bird, the construction paper Santa. Then she reached for the lights Christine had brought. "Did you see John at Creighton's? You knew that he was working there? John's been working there at Christmas for years, since Mr. Creighton fell and broke his ankle hanging the display in the window. He starts as soon as the semester is over." She stretched a string of lights tentatively. "You know he teaches at Oakdale." "He told me, yes. It's a good job. They seem to like him there, and his mother told me they were going to..." "Mom," Christine said, rolling her eyes. "What?" She worked at a kink in the line of lights. "Let's just get these up before Grandma wakes up." They fussed with the lights and the ornaments for a while. Christine's mother was unusually quiet, and that put Christine in a quiet mood too. When they were both satisfied, Mom went off to the kitchen, and when she refused help getting dinner ready, Christine went to the basement to check in on her work before dinner. She'd fallen into graphic design in college and built up a steady list of clients after she and Mike both graduated together. At first, it had been practical. He worked a good job with benefits, and she had the flexibility to stay home and grow her business. After the accident, the work became her savior. The insurance money had allowed her to keep the house, but it was the distraction of deadlines and responsibilities that had kept her going. And modern technology had afforded her the solitude she'd grown more and more to need. She logged on to email, found a reply from a client who wanted changes to a design, and worked on them until it was time to eat. Christine came upstairs to the smell of fresh baked bread and the sound of Grandma maneuvering herself in the wheelchair with her one good leg. Mom was in the living room adjusting the footrest on the chair. Christine went in and kissed Grandma on the cheek, then, before she realized what she was doing, did the same for her mother. "I'll set the table," she offered. As she turned, she noticed the darkness outside and in the room and turned toward the light switch. "Land sakes," Mom said, "I completely forgot." She turned Grandma to face the window and Christine flicked the colored lights on. The room came aglow with reflections of twinkling memories. Grandma squealed, as much as she could with one side of her face still hampered from the stroke. "Janet," she gurgled, looking at Mom, "you found them." "They were right where you said," Mom patted Grandma's shoulder. And while they admired the window, Christine slipped into the kitchen and began arranging plates and silverware. She didn't like seeing her grandma struggle. The recovery seemed too slow. A moment later, Mom pushed Grandma in and nudged her as close to the table as possible, then locked the chair's wheels. "Call your father," she said. And Christine went to the back door and flicked the outside lights, the same signal she'd used since she was a child. Dad appeared from the garage, and Christine saw the blanket of white beginning to fall as he made his way to the house. He stamped his feet on the landing. "Starting to pick up out there," he said. "No sense shoveling until morning." He looked at the front window. "That really looks nice, Ma," he said. And they all sat down to eat. Meals had been especially difficult for Grandma since the stroke, and tonight was worse than usual. Even with her food cut into small pieces, swallowing was often difficult. Dad twice had to get up and gently pound Grandma on the back to clear her throat, and the exertion was clearly tiring for her. Christine watched patiently, wishing there were more she could do. When the table had been cleared, Christine poured coffee and brought out a tin of Springerlees from the pantry. Grandma reached out with her good arm and picked one off the top. "Grandma," Christine said, "where did the Springerlee recipe come from?" Grandma's eyes lit up. "My great, 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 great grandma." She drew a breath. "And probably back farther than that." She wiped the corner of her mouth and swallowed hard. "They came over from the old country." Grandma reached for her coffee. Christine had made her decaf and Mom helped her take a sip. "You remember my sister Berta and Ruthie and Mary?" Christine nodded, and Grandma struggled to clear her throat and get the words out. "Our mothers made them, the old way. They bought bus tickets, and we rode to each other's houses. One family would buy the eggs, another one bought the sugar, and another the anise oil and flour." Grandma stopped as they all waited for her to find her place again. "It took 2 days. The boys beat the eggs. They handed the bowl down, from oldest to youngest. When their arms got tired, they'd start again from the top." Grandma paused, and Christine found herself bending forward, listening. "The men, my father, finished when they got home. Then we made the moles and let them dry overnight. In the morning, we'd ride the bus again and do the baking. It was..." Grandma choked, and they all leaned in toward her. "It was glorious," Grandma stammered. "Glorious." There was a sparkle in Grandma's eye that Christine hadn't seen for a long time, and she wanted to be that little girl, riding the bus and making the Springerlees. "I want you to teach me," she said. Mom looked at her. "A us, Christine said. Maybe. Do you want to? She started, looking at her mother. But Mom was already shaking her head yes. Grandma beamed and made a writing motion with her left hand. Paper, she said. You'll need a shopping list. The snow was shin deep in the morning and still falling. Dad grabbed a sweatshirt and work gloves and went out to shovel. Christine put on thermals, jeans, an extra pair of socks, coat and scarf, a hat, and heavy gloves, then followed him. It took about 2 minutes of shoveling for her to realize she was overdressed. Dad laughed as she tugged at the scarf and pulled her hat off. You used to do this without a coat, and your mother would yell at you. Dad pointed to the window. She's there now. Christine waved at Mom and lowered the zipper on the front of her coat. You'll get me in trouble yet, Dad said, and tossed snow at her. She laughed and tossed a shovelful back. By the time they'd cleaned up that mess and cleared the driveway, breakfast had turned into brunch and the snow was still falling, already turning everything white again. As soon as they'd finished eating, Christine put on her coat and hat. Dad looked at her. Might as well wait a while. Doesn't look like it's going to stop yet. No, Christine said. I'm going to walk to town and get the things for the Springerlees. Why don't you take the car? Mom offered. A mile will seem like a long way in the snow. Christine shook her head. You know I don't want to drive, especially in the snow. She had already emptied her laptop carry case and had it slung over her shoulder. When she rounded the house, the lights in the front window flashed on. She smiled and plunged into the deep snow at the curb. A few people were just beginning to clear the sidewalks. Walking through the one or two sets of tire tracks carved into the street seemed the best way to travel, and not a single car appeared on the roads until she was almost to the two-lane county road that ran through the center of the town. It was like a party downtown. The Emporium was crowded with people buying coffee. There was an army of kids shoveling the sidewalks in front of the stores. The Boy Scouts were selling wreaths at a table in front of the cinema, and the bookmobile was parked at the curb in front of Rogers Market. Nobody seemed to mind the cold or the piles of snow they had to step over and through just to move about. Christine waded through the market, down the narrow aisles, slick with slushy footprints, and found everything she'd need for the Springerlees, except one item. She smiled vaguely at the thought of where she'd have to get it, and carefully packed everything into her bag, then treated herself to a cup of coffee before her last stop. While she was at the Emporium, she poured a second cup, then headed across the street to Creighton's. The library was holding a bake sale in the already crowded hardware store, and then Christine remembered. This building had been the site of the town's first library, and every year on the anniversary of its opening there was a bake sale here, and, she turned to look out the window, a book sale in the bookmobile. She'd begged Mom to bring her here every Saturday before Christmas. Christine bought brownies, a couple of cupcakes, and a bag full of cookies, and stuffed them all into her bag. She was almost out the door when she remembered what she'd come for, and why she'd been juggling a second cup of coffee. John was ringing up an order, and she inconspicuously set the coffee and a brownie next to him by the register and kept going. When she came back with a set of metal measuring spoons, the place was temporarily quiet, and he was unwrapping the brownie and looking at her. To say I'm sorry, she said, for yesterday. I know, John said. It's just been a while. Right, we had some catching up to do. John leaned onto the counter. When was the last time you were home? Christine saw that he immediately recognized the answer and wished he hadn't asked. The funeral, she said, surprised to hear the words come out. Mike's family wanted him to be buried here. John held up a hand. I didn't mean to pry. Christine was silent for a moment. I didn't see you there. John frowned, sighed, set down his brownie, and got a serious look on his face. Look, You know, it broke my heart when he died. I know you really loved him. You two loved each other. That's what made it so hard. How could I pay my respects to that? I would have just gotten in the way. Christine's knees felt soft. You know, I was driving when it happened. I heard that, John said, and I also heard it was the other driver's fault. Everyone kept telling me that, she said. But it never felt okay. The door jangled then, and two young boys ran in and excitedly asked John if they could sweep the walk out front or shovel the curb. He asked if they had their own shovels, and they shook their heads yes and ran back out to work. He turned back to Christine and picked up the measuring spoons. You can't tell me your mother doesn't already have a set of these. It's for the anise oil, she said. It eats through plastic. He looked quizzical. But your grandmother already made the spring earlies. Christine felt a flush of warmth. I'm going to learn. She glanced toward the front window display. And I'm still looking for the perfect gift for Mom and Dad, too. Do you think I might find something here? John rang up the sail and tucked the spoons into Christine's bag for her. They don't need anything else, he said coyly. Making the springerlies took all the rest of that day. Grandma was in the middle of everything, pushing herself around in the wheelchair with her one good leg, sticking her nose into the bowls and checking on everything. Mom and Christine laughed and made a mess, and Dad finished the shoveling once the snow had stopped, then fell asleep in front of the TV. When it was time to roll the dough, Grandma instructed Mom to get down her rolling pin, and she got very serious. You know, Grandma said to Christine, your grandfather carved this rolling pin himself. Christine looked at the pattern of simple shapes, holly berries, an evergreen, a rudimentary dove. They were indelibly etched in her childhood memories. I always stuck some in the back of the freezer for him. For his birthday, he loved those cookies, and he never could figure out how I had them fresh in the spring. Christine rolled the pin carefully and watched the shapes emerge in the dough. By the time they'd cut them all apart, laid them out to dry overnight, and eaten dinner and cleaned everything up, Grandma was already long asleep. As Christine was heading down to the basement for the night, she turned to her mother. Mom, do you know if John Houston ever married? Mom kissed Christine on the cheek. Never, she whispered, and slipped away. Christine logged onto email to check her work before she turned in, paused, and searched for the Oakdale College Chemistry Department's webpage. The next morning, they baked. The springerlies bloomed perfectly, just like they were supposed to, with the little shapes embossed on the tops. Grandma made sure they were wrapped and sealed tightly. We didn't have those plastic bags, she said. If you didn't get a tin of cookies sealed tight, they'd be hard as rocks when you got back to them. She also made sure that the first batch she'd made stayed separate from this new bunch. You know, she said, they're no good for at least 3 weeks. If you eat them before that, the flavor won't go through. She oversaw the whole operation. Mom told Grandma that she was wearing herself out and should slow down. But Grandma wouldn't have any of that. This might be my last Christmas, she said. You're going to let an old lady have her due, won't you? When the last of the cookies were sealed up, Christine called from the pantry. There's no room! Springerlies were spilling out from the shelves, falling onto Christine as fast as she tried to restack them. Grandma, she said, you've got to deliver these. Don't you always give a bunch away? Grandma started. Of course! She lurched forward in her wheelchair. We've got to get going! Christine picked up the phone. Where do we start? The Dickinsons, Grandma called. 765-52 now. Hold on a minute, Mom said. Just who's going to be doing the delivering? Both of us, Christine said, looking at Grandma.
I don't think your grandmother is up to that, Mom said. And the weather. I'm going, Grandma said. Get my coat. I don't think. Let her go, Ma, Dad called from his easy chair in the living room. Better yet, you should all go. All the women. Mom didn't look convinced. I'll clean the car off and bring it around to the side door, Dad said. The wheelchair folds up. We can put it in the trunk. Any trouble, you call me from the cell, and I'll be there with the truck before you can blink. Things went abuzz. Mom helped bundle up Grandma, Christine copied a list of names that Grandma recited, and Dad was outside warming up the car. When they had Grandma safely in the front seat, Mom slid into the back and handed Christine the keys. Christine didn't take them. It's time you got over this, Mom said. You won't get over 20 miles an hour. Christine turned to Dad. Doesn't get much safer than this, he said. And she took the keys and slid in behind the wheel. She drove overly cautious, but it came back to her right away. Driving in the snow, braking before the turn, keeping the wheel straight, rolling stops when there was no one else coming. Mom handled the phone, calling ahead when they could get an answer. But they made their stops regardless of whether someone was home or not. They went to everyone Grandma could think of. Childhood friends who were still alive, or their kids, the senior citizen center, Reverend Martin at the church, Cheryl at the bank, anyone who had ever shown interest in or eaten Grandma Springerly's got some. The street lights were coming on as they made their way home, trying to think of anyone they may have missed. As they edged past the cemetery, Christine looked over in the dim light. It was the first time she'd seen this place since they'd had the service for Mike. He hadn't gotten away any more than she had. And when they pulled into the driveway and she saw the front window all lit up, it came to Christine who they'd forgotten. She'd have to make one more trip to the hardware store tomorrow. Grandma was already awake and at the kitchen table in her wheelchair when Christine came up for coffee in the morning. Mom was in the back of the house somewhere, and Dad was nowhere in sight. Christine filled her mug and sat down next to Grandma. Grandma patted Christine's hand. "Eat some on the 31st, she said. Christine cocked her head. "March 31st. Your grandfather's birthday." Christine got up and took a bag of Springerlees from the pantry, wrapped it inside a sandwich bag, and stuck it all the way in the back of the freezer while Grandma watched. "He always liked it when spring came early," Grandma said. "If I'm not here, you remember." "I will," Christine promised. Mom came in and they had a light breakfast. Then Christine rolled the Schwinn out of the garage and pushed it down the driveway. Smatterings of snow and patches of rough ice glistened on the black pavement. Riding the bike probably wasn't the best idea, but she was going to do it anyway. It would keep her closer to things. She was dressed in layers now, a windbreaker over her winter coat, scarf loose around her neck, her old hiking boots dug out from the back of her closet to keep her feet warm. She was learning to adjust. She checked her pockets, looked back once at the house, then slowly pedaled out into the cleanest tracks through the snow in the street. The gears groaned when she tried to shift, but the chain slipped down into first, and she felt a solidness in the pedal. Everything was quiet and bright in the sunlight reflecting off the white snow. The tires squeaked through the frozen ruts, and Christine rode carefully, turning her face from the wind when she could to keep her eyes from watering. She took her time, and when she reached the school, it was beautifully quiet and pristine. The snow rolled in billowy drifts over the yard. Not a footprint disturbed the scene, and Christine stopped at the curb and looked down along the line of the second-grade wing. Her mother may have forgotten, but Christine had been in Mrs. Kleckner's class, too, at the end of her teaching career, and they had also made Christmas ornaments. And then another thought came back to her.
That was the classroom where she'd first met John. The past kept threading itself into the future, here more than anywhere. She pedaled through the streets downtown and out toward the cemetery. When she got to the gates, there was a wide open expanse of white in front of her, another untouched landscape. Though it had been nearly 5 years since she'd been here and the snow was deep, Christine knew the way. Mike's grave was on the main path under the wide oak where his family plot lay. She pushed her way there and cleared a spot in front of the headstone. "For you, Mike," she said, sitting on the granite and pulling out a springerlee. She took a bite and savored it as long as she could before it melted away. "You always like these," she said, scanning the dips and rolls in the snowdrifts. She took another bite and breathed in the scent. She finished her springerlee, then carefully resealed the bag and tucked it back into her pocket. "I hope you don't mind," she said, "but there's an old friend I have to go see." She paused, sniffed deeply, and drew the cold air down into her lungs, then let it out. "You know him, and you know we dated before you and I got together. That's especially important now. I think you'll understand." Christine waited quietly, hoping for an answer, but knowing it wouldn't come that easily. Then she got up to walk back down to her bike and made her way to the hardware store. Tonight was Christmas Eve, and she had one last batch of springerlees to deliver before the spring thaw.
Spring Early was written by Scott Geisel. His work has appeared in several journals and anthologies, most recently Christmas Stories from Ohio from the Kent State University Press. Thanks to Mary Donahoe for her reading and to WISO volunteer David Neely for editing help.
You're listening to a Christmas special from 91.3 WISO in Yellow Springs, Ohio. The human heart has a need to connect, especially at this time of year when it's dark and cold. So we bring you now stories from the village of Yellow Springs, gathered at the post office during one long day by WISO reporters and volunteers. It's an audio time capsule about a small town with a long history on the first day of the holiday mailing season, the Monday after Thanksgiving, 2010. Emily McCord was the first reporter to arrive at 7:45 a.m. While she waited in the lobby for the customer window to open, light glowed from behind the wall of post office boxes, little glass doors with numbers and stories inside each one, waiting to be told. At 8 a.m. sharp, the window flew open, like the curtain going up on a play, and there is Postmaster Dave Kennedy.
Is there something about being a postmaster that nobody else would know except for people that are postmasters?
Well, one of the things is you're appointed by the Postmaster General. That certificate up there, that's a little bit different than most jobs with the post office, an appointed position, so you put in for it. But what comes with that is the responsibility of the office. So things go wrong, it falls on your shoulders. But it does give you a sense of pride knowing that you got appointed the position, that they had the confidence in you to give you the position.
Dave presides proudly as villagers come. He and the staff are familiar faces.
I love them. They're like friends and family, and they've been very helpful in many ways. And one of the clerks, Molly, even one time to send a suit for my son, we packed it all together so that he could go on an interview for his job, which he was successful at, and so he got a job. So they're just like family and friends.
That's Tina Wingate, and here's Ruth Oshbacher.
It's been wonderful. They even, since I have a heart attack, they even deliver the mail right to my door. And one day when I couldn't answer the door, the driver went and got the police to come to see that I was all right. You couldn't find that in the big city.
And this is Greg Dewey. He grew up here.
So, you know, I came in with my mom and dad when I was little and still come here. And it's still the same good old office. I mean, it seemed really huge then. You know, I thought it was like a gigantic place. And, you know, these boxes seemed magical to me. I didn't know what they were, you know, because we didn't have one. But what are those? I thought, you know, there was like treasures in them or something. And they used to have the people, the wanted guys up, you know, and I was afraid of that part. I'd go, walking around. Yeah, I didn't want to look at the bad guys.
The post office was built in 1941. It has a high ceiling and tall windows, a certain smell, and those wonderful desks where you can stand and write.
My name is Catherine Hitchcock, and I live in the village of Yellow Springs, and I'm really glad this post office is here. I guess I'm sort of proud of this little post office, you know, that you go in the suburbs and they're like in strip malls, and they're ugly. They're just ugly, and see the window over here that says stamps? Mm-hmm. They didn't find that until they cut a big hole there. Have you heard that story?
Yeah.
And that had been covered over, so Dave, our postmaster, said, well, leave it. And, of course, it has no purpose other than it's part of the history of the building. Mm-hmm. So in this little building here that isn't terribly grand but has all these nice little, it's nice in here, and it's cozy and people are friendly, and that's a reminder of the 1940s.
Well, I used to have a post office box here, and it was like belonging to a fraternity. Every morning, all the post office box people would meet, and we had a special friendship. One of my favorite post office box friends was Orvi Kirshner, I think his name was. And he, at the time, was 90, so he'd been the postmaster or the postman, so he knew everyone and everything. And then the Eamon guy who had the fire hydrant checking place, who'd been, like, to Mongolia and, you know, had his anniversary north of the Arctic Circle. I mean, people had really interesting stories. And I got my mail, so that's a good thing.
That was Donna. She talked to Jerry Kenny, who took over at 10:30 in the morning. Jerry found a lady well-known in the village. She came to town in 1943. Her name is Wilberta Eastman, known as Billy.
I love the story that came down to me when I first came to Yellow Springs. There was a young man who, let's say, just didn't have quite all of his wits with him, and he worked for the post office. And he would take the mail from the post office down to the railroad station, because then the mail went out by rail. That's when we had a railroad going through here. And oh, that was a very important job for this man who just loved being a part of the workings of the universe. And he had a bull whip, and he would go down the street with his mail, and he would crack his whip as he went along.
Why did he crack that whip? As if to say, I'm on important business, get out of my way?
Important. You see, people have been overlooking me all these times, and now I got an important job, and boy, I'm going to let people know it. That's what Yellow Springs is. They look to the needs of everybody. Here was a young man, energetic, wanted to be important, and they gave him a job.
Just as Jerry's getting the warm fuzzies, in pops a young guy, moving fast and all business.
I'm Anthony Berry, and I'm the owner over at Superfly Comics and Games. It's holiday season. We got all kinds of internet sales going on all the time, and it's just really kicked up lately. Comics and action figures and related stuff, everything that goes out our door goes to this post office.
Juliette Frumholt took over from Jerry, and she found Nason McElargy, a local potter.
I couldn't live without it. I mean, I have a business, my own business, and I ship a lot, so I prefer to ship USPS, and it's convenient for me. And it gives me an excuse to come downtown.
Hello, I'm Luke Brennan. I live in Yellow Springs.
Do you come to the post office often?
I do. I come here at least once a month to get a money order for rent. And also occasionally to mail things.
Do you find it convenient to have a post office right here in town?
Yeah, I like that. I You know, there's some things I don't like about the post office. Like they're closed on like really obscure holidays, and UPS isn't. So then I end up you know going to a UPS. But the post office in general I think is pretty cool. You know, you get door to door across the country less than a dollar. I think that's neat.
Do you think how would it affect you if we didn't have a post office here in Yellow Springs? If you had to go to like Fairborn or Springfield or Xenia or something?
Well, depending on how much time I had, I feel like if I had about 3 years, I could replace everything the post office does with email. No offense. If I could print out a shipping label from my bed, you know, like, and then slap it on a box and then stumble out to the mailbox and throw it in, that would definitely be more convenient than coming down here.
Do you think we'll be printing shipping labels from bed one day? Postmaster Dave isn't worried about that.
To me, I may be a little old-fashioned. I'm a firm believer in cycles. And technology is technology. It goes in cycles. People enjoy new technology, but it just goes for a period of time, and people will go back to the old ways a little bit. And I think people miss that communication, the handwritten letter. You can store an email on your computer, but you can get a letter. You can put it in your dresser drawer and keep it. You can keep it on your refrigerator, just like you do your kids when they make cards up for you. There's a difference.
The difference is the human heart. That connection we need and want, and we can get it at the post office.
And it's just a swell gathering place. It's a place where one can walk in and undoubtedly see somebody they know. It just represents the best of the community.
Marcia Sauer came to town as a student in the early 70s. She was interviewed by WYSO volunteer Katie Tilley, who's new to town this year. Sarah Buckingham just came back to town, and she likes hearing old stories. At the post office, she met Ed Dressler, who was a little nervous about being interviewed, but did want Sarah to know about the mural on the lobby wall. Maybe you've seen it. A man is sitting on a log, reading a book. It went up just after the post office was built, and Ed remembers those days.
How does that make you feel when you look at it? What do you think about?
Hard time, but at the same time, given an opportunity to, he's reading a book. Obviously, he must have been in one of the education programs or the arts programs funded by the federal government during the Depression. Hard work, like an Abraham Lincoln in a way. Hard work and hard telling where you're going to end up. So I'm real big on that era because I was a former park director and Green County, we have a roadside rest area up on 42, and that was built by the CCC, and it's still there. It's the only one left in Green County, and very few like it anywhere in Ohio. So.
The CCC was the Civilian Conservation Corps. Ed remembers the Great Depression, when people had to be creative in order to survive, not unlike today.
Mind if I ask you what you're mailing?
My 15-year-old has an eBay business, and this is all his stuff. He sells things on eBay.
What does he sell?
These are CD players, like the big kind. You can put a sound system. He got them from Goodwill for like $5.99. He sold them for $25. And I've made like three trips. This is real convenient from where I work. I could just come here. It's easier than, I live in Springfield. It's easier to come here than there. So.
And so is he making a lot of money this way?
Yeah, he made $2,000 this summer. He goes to garage sales and gets the family and everything, anything anybody wants to get rid of, and he sells it. He does his postage, and all they have to do is stop here. He does everything.
Does it seem like it's picking up for the holidays now?
It just depends on the summer. He went to a lot more garage sales and found more junk. So he sold everything that we possibly ever would use at our house. So now he's running out of stuff.
Tony Barry from Superfly Comics is not running out of stuff. He's back again with a huge stack of manila envelopes.
Do you mind if I bug you for a minute, Tony?
I actually already did an interview today.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, this is my second trip.
This is your second trip to the post office?
More. Yes.
Can I ask you what you're mailing on your second trip?
All kinds of comics and I forget what else. Action figures. We got a bunch of Barbies in there that we're selling on consignment for somebody. It's all Amazon sales mostly. I mean, everything that goes out our door is going through these guys' hands.
Were you expecting to have to come back today?
Yes. Yes, it's late November. Holiday season has definitely kicked in. I expect to come back 3 or 4 times today.
A young guy in a big brimmed hat comes in, named Eric. He's known as Brother Wolf. The hat has a feather.
This post office to me represents the positive ability of government to do good things for good people. And I think that as Americans, we have a tendency to focus on the aspects of government that fail us or seem intrusive, while the aspects that are successful we ignore. And I think this post office is a standing monument to the success of government and how it can serve people. Because honestly, my business could not exist without the post office. If I was trying to do what I do with UPS or FedEx, it wouldn't work.
What's your business?
I'm a professional storyteller, and I mail packages to some of my guests for my show, and it's just very cost-effective to do it at the post office.
And can I ask you about what you're mailing today, a little holiday stuff, or just taking care of day-to-day business?
No, I was just going to see if I'm expecting a package back from a guest today, but it looks like it'll be tomorrow.
Eric sends people a small digital recorder. He's collecting stories through the mail. Dr. Carl Hyde is doing something similar.
I correspond with a lot of inmates on Ohio death row. So I usually send letters or cards 2 or 3 times a week. And I come in to send them and to buy stamps. I'm a Quaker, and I'm very much opposed to executions. So that has led me to communicate with the men on death row, to exchange letters with a number of them. They're all different and all interesting. And many of them don't get much correspondence. So for some, it's the only letter they get.
It's that heart-to-heart feeling we want and the sense of touch. Diana Partee prefers to mail her packages from the post office for just that reason.
Because I get to touch them and wrap them and put a little personal feel to them. And I think I'm going to have one bag this year that's going to be Mother Says, and then I'm going to put little things in it, like things to clean your teeth more closely that I've noticed. And then our eye doctor told us to be sure and shampoo your eyebrows and eyelashes with baby shampoo once or twice a week. Little old critters can get in there, and you can't see them, but that's what she told us. It's like, they can feel me. Or, they can say, oh, Mom, and roll their eyes and whatever they need to do, but because they're not going to be here. Sometimes they are, but this year they're not going to be. So to me it's even more important to put the hand touch on it and send it to them.
A lady named Peggy knows about the hand touch, too. She comes into the post office late in the day with a package that she insists on sending first class. No media rate for her. She wants to be absolutely certain that the package arrives.
Favorite person to come down here and mail things to is my little great-niece, who's 7 in Michigan.
What kind of stuff do you send her?
She always looks forward to the packages from Peggy. They're always, ooh, good. It could be all sorts of anything, It could be a scarf. It could be books. It could be seasonal kinds of stuff. It could be seashells from the seashore. I mailed her a bunch of buckeyes in the fall. It's just a various a sundry of things, but she likes them when they get an Ohio postmark.
Peggy spends the $5 it costs to send a little bit of herself to a friend.
Just put that penny in the penny thing.
All right. I'll get you the receipt. There you go. Thank you now.
Postmaster Dave makes change for her. He's still cheerful, still has time to talk to customers at the end of a very long day. Good thing, because here comes Tony one more time.
Hello again. What do you got this time?
More comics.
And this is what, trip number?
This is trip number 3 for the day. Jared is still up at the store packing more packages.
So, Dave, are there a lot of folks like Tony here who come in multiple times throughout the day?
Nobody like Tony.
If they didn't close so early, you'd probably still bring your packages down to, 8 or something.
You're mailing this right here in Yellow Springs?
Yeah.
You could drop this off to him on the way down the street.
Yes. If I have one available. Yeah.
5 reporters contributed to this story: Emily McCord, Jerry Kenny, Juliet Fromholt, Katie Tilley, and Sarah Buckingham, plus freelance producer Katie Davis. Thanks to Dave Kennedy and the post office staff and all the folks in Yellow Springs who took their time to chat. I'm Nina Ellis. From all of us at WYSO, happy holidays and a happy new year, too.
Thank you, Nina. Have a good evening.
You too.
All right, that's it for us. We're going to close up.
We'll leave you now with a song performed by a quartet of Yellow Springs students. They are Rory Papania, Jamie Scott, Sam Salazar, and Sam Crawford. They called themselves Wheels. This was a live performance here at WYSO earlier this week, mixed by Tim Berger. It's a tune by Edward Sharp and the Magnetic Zeros called Home.
Alabama, Arkansas, I do love my mom, Pa, not the way that I do love you.
Well, holy moly, me, oh my, you're the apple of my eye, girl, I never loved one like you.
Well, man, oh man, you're my best friend, I scream it to the nothingness, girl, we got everything we need. Hot and heavy pumpkin pie, chocolate candy, Jesus Christ, girl, ain't nothing to please me more than you.
Oh, let me come home. Home is wherever there is you. Home, let me come home. Home is wherever there is you.
You're listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org. WYSO is a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley.
Home is where